Welcome back to Sounds of Dissent. I'm Amy Grunder. Sudbury resident Tarek Mahana was sentenced to 17 and a half years in federal district court in Boston on Thursday after his conviction last December for allegedly providing material support to Al-Qaeda. According to reports of the case, the evidence of his crimes, seven charges in all, consisted of traveling to Yemen in an unsuccessful attempt to seek training in terrorism, and of translating publicly available text and videos and posting them on the Internet. The 29-year-old American-born U.S. citizen held a doctoral degree from the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Civil rights advocates say his conviction represents the increasing criminalization of speech under the Bush and the Obama administrations. We're joined in the studio this afternoon by J.W. Carney, Jr., a defense attorney for Tarek Mahana. J. Carney has practiced criminal law for 34 years, handling thousands of cases in the district, superior, and federal courts in Massachusetts, including over 175 jury trials of major felonies. After earning his degree from Boston College Law School, Mr. Carney served as a public defender in Boston and became assistant district attorney in 1983. He has been listed in the Best Lawyers in America for over 10 years. Boston Magazine named him one of the five best private criminal defense lawyers in the state. Mr. Carney is a fellow of the American College of Trial Lawyers, the most prestigious bar association in the country. He was assigned Tarek Mahana's case as a public defender. J. Carney, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
This case has had very little attention, actually, most of the time, except when there's an actual conviction or trial. There's been very little press coverage until recently, and now, of course, coverage is reverberating throughout the national and international media. I wonder, though, if we could start, because it's significant, because of the free speech implications. But for the benefit of listeners who may not be familiar with the case, can you tell us the substance of these accusations against Tarek Mahana?
The primary accusation was that he provided material support to terrorist organizations by posting supportive comments on web forums, by translating Arabic documents into English so that people who did not speak Arabic could read them, as well as sharing videos that are focused on the resistance to the coalition forces in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other Muslim countries.
How are these actions material support for terrorism? For the uninformed, material support would seem to be something like giving money or giving some kind of actually doing something besides posting a video. Could you tell us the law behind this, what the statute is, and maybe a relevant case so that we can understand this?
There have been hundreds of prosecutions under the terrorism laws that were passed by the Congress before and after 9/11. All of them have involved traditional material support, such as giving money, providing weapons, doing sophisticated training, providing safe houses, things that one would normally associate with providing support to a terrorist organization. This case is unprecedented under the federal law in that the primary thing that Tarek was charged with was based on his speech. He would take postings in Arabic and translate them into English so that Americans could read them. He would take videos produced by people resisting the war in Iraq and share them with people. And he would be supportive of the effort to expel an invading army from a Muslim country. He did not support almost all other tenets of the terrorist group Al-Qaeda. For example, Al-Qaeda would say it's justified to kill any American because of the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. Tariq adamantly opposed that. He said this is simply a military resistance, and that military resistance is justified. He gave a very powerful, eloquent speech at sentencing where he told how he came to this point of view and how he had studied in history how Americans had expelled the British because of the oppression that the British government was doing in the American colonies. He talked about other people who have waged fights against apartheid or slavery or discrimination. And he compared what he was doing to that. And I think he was justified.
Well, I'm thinking about civil liberties advocates are focused on the implications for free speech, regardless of what he believed or what he said or whether we agree with it or not. I wonder if you can explain the 2010 case, Holder versus the Humanitarian Law Project. And there, the Supreme Court ruled that even protected speech can be a criminal act if it occurs at the direction of a terrorist organization. Was there evidence that Tariq Mahana posted these videos at the request of al-Qaeda or someone from al-Qaeda? Was any evidence like that even presented?
None whatsoever. And that was very troubling to us because what the government alleged was that Tariq was in a conspiracy with anyone who supported his view that the coalition forces should be expelled from Iraq and Afghanistan, so that the government was able to introduce statements by everyone from Osama bin Laden and his number two person in al-Qaeda to independent speakers in other countries in the world. And what the government contended is that Tariq was involved in this global conspiracy, when realistically, Tariq was supportive of the United States and other coalition forces getting out of Iraq in particular. But that's a view shared by many, many people who are not holding that view because they're at the direction of or in coordination with al-Qaeda. This is the essence, to me, of free speech. The U.S. Supreme Court said that if you act independently to support these causes, it will not be a crime. But the government contended that just agreeing with these positions made you a co-conspirator with people who advocated all kinds of violence to support the Muslim countries that were being attacked.
How is that operating at the direction? So you're that's a different standard conspiracy, isn't it? How is he operating at the direction by you're saying that, in other words, if I understand you, just by collaborating with other people who felt the way he did or maybe held more extreme positions by having a relationship solely by posting their material up on the internet, that made him doing it at the request of a terrorist organization. I'm having a hard time getting my head around this.
One example of the hypocrisy involved in this prosecution was the fact that the government called as an expert witness an individual who himself has a website where he has posted videos and translated statements by Osama bin Laden and others. He contends he's doing it as an educational service. And therefore, although Tariq was posting the identical videos, the government said Tariq was providing material support, whereas the government's expert was just providing an educational service. The hypocrisy in this case was breathtaking.
So Cuba is designated as a state sponsor of terrorism. It can't be a terrorist because under law, only non-state actors can be terrorists. But if I suppose it's the Cuban Revolution is underway and I want to download and translate Fidel Castro, is that material support for terrorism? Or thinking about the opposition to apartheid in South Africa, I'm thinking about the implications for dissent here. The African National Congress was considered a terrorist group at the time by members of the U.S. government. So if someone were to post videos about post videos in support of overturning the apartheid rule in South Africa under this rule, would that be considered material support for terrorists?
Under the government's theory in this case, the answer is yes. What I tried to point out to the jury was that in the most undemocratic countries in the world, when an effort is made by its citizens to try to change things, the country will crack down, often by preventing people from getting access to the internet. China has done that. Iran has done that. And what they do is they try to prevent people from seeing the statements of others who are supportive of their point of view. This is what's done in a dictatorship. The United States government, in this case, is trying to do the same thing. No one disputes that it is legal to look on the internet and read statements in Arabic put out by people who are trying to expel invading armies from Muslim countries. It's legal to read it if it's in Arabic. And if you speak Arabic, you're not in any danger. But if you don't speak Arabic, you can't understand it. What Tariq tried to do is present this in English form so that people could read the views of others in the world. The United States disagrees with those positions and doesn't want Americans to be reading it, and so prosecuted Tariq simply for translating it from one language to another.
Closer to home, I'd just like to mention we had the journalist Seymour Hersh with us last week, and he reported that prominent members of the U.S. political establishment were raising funds for an Iranian dissident slash terrorist group called the Mujahideen-e Khalq, which is actually on the State Department list of terrorist organizations, yet members of the government have actually raised funds for them because they're seen as opposition to Iran. Now, of course, under this rule, it sounds like they would certainly be implicated as well. So I get the double standard here. But Tariq Mahana's prosecutor, Aloke Chakravarti, said, according to reports again, that Tariq Mahana served as the media wing for al-Qaeda. So he wasn't, the implication here, at least in some of the reports I'm seeing, is not that he was just translating Arabic texts opposing the U.S. occupation of Iraq or parts of the Muslim world or having bases and that sort of thing, but that he was actually translating, and again, I get that this, under law, this should, this appears to be free speech, but the implication is that he was translating documents that were al-Qaeda documents. Is that right?
Some of the documents were produced by al-Qaeda. Some of them were produced by other individuals who had no connection to terrorist organizations. The important thing is that these are words. We may completely disagree with what a foreign organization believes, but in the United States, the essence of the First Amendment is that we get to make a decision about that after we read it, after we hear what other people have to say. It's so troubling that our government wants to put a lock on this kind of discussion. In the United States, you should be able to make your own decision on whether you will support or not support something based on its merit and not based on the fact that the government will not allow you to hear what the other side is saying.
Along these lines, I'd like to ask about the claim of domestic radicalization. There are real concerns about the radicalization of young people, not just in the United States, but in other countries as well. And here I'm thinking of the murders of Jewish school children and a rabbi in Marseille, France, a few weeks ago by a young man, 23 years old, named Mohamed Merah. He's a French citizen. Well, he was, because police killed him during a shootout. He was a French citizen, and he had traveled, like your client who went to Yemen. He had traveled to Afghanistan, and I believe he went to Israel as well. And he was a fan of, this is Mohammed Merah, was a fan of so-called jihadi websites. And he claimed his inspiration for these murders, he claimed inspiration from Al-Qaeda. And so now, on Wednesday, the French government just unveiled new counterterrorism legislation to punish those who regularly visit extremist websites, so-called extremist websites, I'm not sure how they're going to define those, or who travel to weapons training camps abroad. Now, this is exactly what Tarek Mahana was accused of. Is this the direction that the law is going? And would you say that that French law is actually even further along in that direction?
I think that French law would be held to be unconstitutional by any federal court that looked at it. You cannot prevent people from going on the internet and looking at sites that put forward views in politics that the United States does not agree with. In other countries in the world, you can be prosecuted for hearing what the other side says. In the United States, you're not supposed to be able to be prosecuted for that. I find the French law criminalizing someone looking at a website where a unpopular view is posted to be very, very scary.
There was a similar case to Mahana's case not too long ago. Well, actually, yes, it was in 2003, it looks like. A University of Ohio graduate student named Sami Omar al-Hussein, who was also prosecuted for administering a website that merely linked to extremist sermons and jihadi sites that solicited donations to what are called, in this article at least, extremist groups. This is a great article, by the way. I'm reading from a piece by Adam Serwer. It's worth reading. It's in Mother Jones. It's called "Does Posting Jihadist Material Make Tarek Mahana a Terrorist?" And it was published last December. But anyway, so there's a quote here of the attorney for this Saudi American. Relied on the testimony of a former CIA official named Frank Anderson, who testified that people don't become terrorists just because of what they read on the internet. He says, recruitment is personal and requires the identification, assessment, and persuasion of candidates. This is what Anderson told Mother Jones, and that this particular client was not involved in any of this. And apparently your defense team also called a former CIA official, Mark Sageman, to testify that the ability to recruit people over the internet is in fact a reach and is not really based on fact.
That's true. The government just fabricated theories in this case that had no support whatsoever in studies done by academics or people in the intelligence community. For example, the government said in this case that by Tarek sharing videos with people, that radicalized the people and made them decide to become terrorists.
There's no evidence of this, though, right?
Nothing. Nothing whatsoever. The government called five close friends of the defendant to show that the defendant would show them videos or support efforts to get soldiers out of countries like Iraq, also Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Yemen. And the government said, well, this radicalized them and caused them to become terrorists. Yet none of them did. All of them continue to live in the United States. Not a single one has gone to a country to engage in war. And this was Tarek trying to express his views and share his views openly with people. Should not be a crime.
Let's talk about that trial. You're saying the government presented evidence in the form of the testimony of people who were acquaintances of Tarek Mahana, who apparently turned against him. I understand from the reports also that Tarek Mahana was under surveillance for some time, and I'm wondering what the content of this evidence was against him and if he was able to even see it. There's mention in another in various reports I've looked at of monitoring of email or monitoring his chats, his online chats with his friends about opposing what the U.S. was doing in the Arab world and other and wishing they could go and fight and that kind of thing. Was there evidence other than those chats and these witnesses?
The government had Tarek Mahana under intense surveillance for 5 years. They obtained a search warrant that allowed them to secretly go into his home and make a copy of his computer hard drive, make copies of documents that were found in his bedroom, and basically turn his house inside out to get every single bit of information they could. In addition, they wiretapped his telephone so that they could record his calls. They had access to his email. They saved all his instant messages. They had friends of Tarek persuaded to record conversations with Tarek. The government knew everything about this man and took no action for 5 years because they realized he was not a danger of causing any harm to any individual. Tarek's threat was by his words, not by his actions.
I'd like to get to the prosecution's motive here. There's a suggestion in some of the press reports that he was, he was, according to his own words, he was asked to be an informant by the FBI, and he refused, and reformed against others. So he may have been being cultivated for intelligence. But what do you think the motive was? Is that what you think the motive was that he was somehow being made an example of because he wasn't cooperating, or Tarek Mahana's opinions are not that unusual. Why would they be trying to repress his words? They're common. Many Americans express them.
Tarek was a charismatic speaker. He's a leader. The speech he gave at sentencing was a powerful, powerful message that people should oppose the oppression wherever they see it of individuals because of their religious beliefs, because of their political beliefs. And Tarek used as examples Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King as people who fought against injustice. Tarek views himself in the same way, and that's the biggest threat that the government sees. They tried to get him to be an informant against the Muslim community, and he refused. The government can put enormous pressure on people to do that, and Tarek was, if not unique, certainly one of the very, very few people who was able to resist that pressure. It's instructive in this case that the lead witness against Tarek had been a friend of his, someone who he'd known for many years. He was older than Tarek by 4 years, and he shared the same views as Tarek. But he did so much more than Tarek ever did. This individual I'm talking about was the one who proposed shooting up a shopping mall, which Tarek opposed and said, that's ridiculous. He went to New Hampshire to try to get automatic weapons to try to commit a violent act against civilians. Tarek opposed that. He suggested doing a violent act at Hanscom Air Force Base. Tarek, again, opposed it. When this person was initially questioned by the FBI, he lied repeatedly about what he had done in his own background. And yet, once he agreed to become a cooperator, an informant, the government lost all interest in prosecuting him, and he was not charged with a single crime. Why? Because he agreed to be an informant. I think the real message that's coming out on this case to people is that if the FBI wants you to be an informant against your community, you had better do it, or you're going to be facing the full weight of the federal government against you.
I'm here with J.W. Carney, Jr. He is the attorney, one of the defense attorneys for Tarek Mahana, a Sudbury man who was just sentenced to 17 years for his, is it 17 and a half years for allegedly providing material support to Al-Qaeda. That was the charge and that was the conviction. I think we have time for one more question here. In the sentencing hearing, apparently there was a jury at the sentencing hearing and prosecutors were trying to get a 25-year sentence. They got a 17 and a half year sentence. The judge was quoted in reports as saying there was something horrifying about Tarek Mahana's religious enthusiasm and that he was influenced in he could have given him a lesser sentence. He was influenced in this sentence by Mahana's lack of remorse. Now, I don't know if this is the same judge that presided over the trial of Tarek Mahana or if he even had a chance to interact with Tarek Mahana, but could you respond?
Yes, this was the trial judge who presided over Tarek's trial. The trial lasted 9 weeks from October into December of last year, and he was the judge who imposed the sentence.
Do you have any sense of why he said there was something horrifying about Tarek Mahana's religious enthusiasm?
When Tarek was young, as a teenager or in his early 20s, he made statements supportive of getting the United States out of the country Iraq. And he used some very graphic language about this. And this graphic language is troubling to anyone, but it was language used with his friends and on recorded conversations that were had with him. While the language he used was unfortunate, it was crude, it was hurtful, it was only speech. And he should not, in my opinion, have been prosecuted for his speech.
Thank you for being with us today, J.W. Carney, Jr. We've been speaking with J.W. Carney, Jr. He is the attorney for the defense attorney for Tarek Mahana, who was just sentenced to 17 and a half years in federal district court in Boston on Thursday after a conviction for, quote, providing material support to terrorists, unquote. My name is Amy Grunder for Sounds of Dissent.